Welcome to the History Hotline, a direct line to a better understanding of all things Black history and beyond. Everyone, and welcome to episode 137 of the History Hotline. My name is Deanna Lincook, and as always, I'll be your host today. Now, today's episode is taking us back to 1961, and in the context of this episode and Britain's history at the time, I should note that at this moment in 1961, as is the case in Britain today, in 2024, the country was hotly debating probably the hottest topic on political lips since the 1905 Aliens Act, and any guesses for what that is? Immigration! And I'll get back to that soon, but more excitingly and more pressingly, we are having a live show! I enjoy that klaxon way too much. I might bring it back again outside of this advertisement. But yes, the History Hotline is having its first ever live show, and it's going to be at St. James's Place, King's Cross in London, as part of the London Podcast Festival on Sunday, the 15th of September, 2 p.m. It feels like a lifetime away, but tickets are, I'm going to say they're limited, but you know, there is not an infinite number of tickets. They, I hope, will sell out at some point soon. So please, if you do want to go, get your tickets as soon as possible. I'm so, so excited to have been given this opportunity to have a live show, be part of the festival, and hopefully, you know, continue to share these histories with you live in the flesh, meet some of you listeners, and thank you essentially for what will by then be over 4 years of support, of listening, and of sharing these histories that are just so important. I'm really looking forward to it. Make sure you get your tickets in good time. And yeah, links are in the show notes and also on social media. If you have any questions, reach out to us on social media or via email. Anyway, back to immigration. And you know, if you've been listening here, you know it's something I love. But what I don't love when it comes to immigration is the way that it's used as a political pawn and a hot topic to separate the right and the far right and even the left. Today, within the context of immigration, we're talking about Rwanda, illegal and legal immigration, small boats. But back then in 1961, it was Commonwealth immigration, trying to control the numbers of people arriving, especially people from India or of Indian descent immigrating from East Africa, Caribbean people, and generally the wider populations of non-white immigrants arriving from the ever-developing Commonwealth countries at the time. And during this period, the 1948 Nationality Act, that is in 1961, was 13 years old, and Britain had essentially had increasing levels of this kind of migration, Commonwealth migration, colonies, migration of the colonies, for 13 years. And politicians were calling for it to be curbed immediately from pressure from the right wing portions of society and from political figures that were pushing for this. In the period immediately before this and before this kind of 1962 Act, which is kind of the point at which we're at in this episode, the entry of dependents into Britain increased almost threefold because families were trying to beat the act. And it's something that I think about a lot in my PhD research, because there were fears that Britain were essentially going to close its borders very soon to the citizens of the Commonwealth. And it wouldn't matter if you already had family in Britain, you would be barred. And so at this point, a lot of families that were in Britain, parents that were in Britain, people that were there already and wanted to send for other members of family, whether that be children or siblings or parents, they were trying to beat the act. And so it meant that immigration really did peak and really did grow within the kind of last year and the months leading up to this act that was incoming. And it was something that was being discussed and something that was going through. So people were very aware that it was going to happen. Now, National Archive records from the report of committee ministers regarding colonial immigrants suggest that conversations at that time within that committee of ministers were thinking through this issue of migration from, and I quote, coloured territories. They were, you know, discussing the ways in which the public might react to a law that was essentially racist. Let's call a spade a spade. And so they didn't want to be accused of it being racially motivated, even though it was essentially targeting, quote unquote, coloured territories. And they knew that there wasn't really a way that they could pass it off with it being non-discriminatory or reading that way and coming across that way. And so they kind of had to find a way to flip it. And this is why, like, when you think about immigration today, like, politicians ain't slick, because the same twisting, turning, sugarcoating, mincing words that was done back then is being done now. And so they decided to emphasise the housing shortages to really push this agenda that they couldn't take in any more people, even though what they were actually saying was, we can't take in any more coloured people. They passed it off as, we can't take any more people in. But it's really the same kind of rhetoric as we have today. In years gone by, we've seen, you know, the country even leave the EU over immigration as one of the real core voting points and talking points of that referendum. However, you know, a few years later, when it came to people fleeing Ukraine, white people fleeing Ukraine, we were able to find space for them with very little comment. However, now we have other conflicts happening globally. We have people arriving in these dinghies that are unsafe. They're being, you know, taken across by people that are only in it for the money across the channel to get to Britain, and we don't have room for them at all. But let me not get political. Let me stick to the history today. But essentially, my point is that they're using the same political jargon and tactics and kind of smoke and mirrors to push a very arguably, not arguably, I'm arguing that it's not arguably, racist agenda, essentially. So as these numbers have increased, these immigrant numbers increased to beat the bill, government ministers are trying to figure out a way to get these bills through without appearing racist and it not appearing to be about race, which kind of laughable because we can all read between the lines. And so obviously, as I said, they're using housing. Now, it's not to say that housing wasn't an actual pressing issue at the time, as it is now. But as I said, if they were serious on curbing the population due to housing, then all kinds of immigrants would be targeted. Governments from Commonwealth countries would obviously be aware of this. They would know that migration is about to lessen out of their countries to Britain. And fully understanding the ways that migration was alleviating some of the social issues in their own countries, they decided to come to Britain. And the person in question I'm speaking about is Norman Manley. Norman Manley, at the time being the Prime Minister of Jamaica, he served from 1959 to 1962. This was 1961. Not to be confused with his son, Michael Manley, who would go on to also serve as Prime Minister, but from 1972 to 1980, and then again in 1989 to 1992. I say this not to confuse you, but literally to clarify for myself, because I always get those two confused. I know, like, the two different people and, like, what they did, but I actually always get the names wrong, and it doesn't help that I think Michael Manley's middle name is Norman. And it's sometimes written as, like, Michael Norman Manley. And I'm like, which one is it? I don't know. Anyway, Norman Manley makes a trip to Britain, specifically Birmingham, which we love. And it reminded me of Malcolm X visiting Birmingham. And he visits four Jamaican families in the city to see how they're getting on in their new country and also make some speeches on this so-called immigration problem that Britain is dealing with. And I found this really interesting because he's visiting families in Britain to see and kind of check in that things have gone the way they had hoped, expected, wanted to. And this was how I actually got to know about his visit at all. I was looking for stories and images of Caribbean children that migrated to Britain, and I found this picture of 7 children, 5 black children, 2 white children, sitting in what looks like a typically Caribbean decorated front room in Britain. 2 of the children are on Norman Manley's lap. And I was looking at the picture for ages thinking, I know who that man is. Like, that man is so familiar. But this just looks like someone's living room. So how would I know this man? Like, and then it was, you know, the link was a Birmingham Live article. So I was like, maybe I just know him from the community. No, it was Norman Manley. Obviously figured out who it was. But then I wondered, well, why was he in England? I didn't know that he visited during this time and then actually, you know, went to the houses of Jamaican people that were now living in Britain. And then I also started to wonder, well, how much did Caribbean leaders of those nations where people left en masse essentially and migrated to Britain, how often did they do this? Did they think about those populations and groups of people that had left? Did they care about what was happening to them overseas? Did they still see them as, you know, part of their communities or part of their populations that they should have to care about? And I guess it kind of shows that they did, because here is Mr. Manley in Britain, you know, talking to these families and checking in, essentially. And I guess it's good to say at this point also, just to clarify, Jamaica is still technically a colony. It's still a British colony. They get independence in 1962, so very soon. So they're rapidly moving towards independence, but they aren't independent. So maybe it does also explain the closer links with the Prime Minister and Britain at that time. So where did this image come from? Well, I traced it back to a Birmingham Live article, as I said, written by Andy Richardson on the 18th of June 2018, and I will link that in the show notes. And it centred the story of Jacinth Ivy from King's Heath, whose parents, Maurice and Carmen Brown, came over to Birmingham in 1952. And it was their picture of the Jamaican Prime Minister Norman Manley visiting their home in 1961. And here is a clip from the article.
Hello, my name's Jacinth Ivy, and my parents came here from Jamaica in 1952. So they came, the two of them, young, very, very young, with their ambitious selves. And my father tells me that they were met with stares and met with hostility. When they tried to get housing, there were the signs that said no coloureds, no Irish and no dogs. So I was born in 1959 and I have 4 siblings. So 3 brothers and a sister who's unfortunately passed away. But there were 5 of us that moved in and lived in this large house. In 1961, the then Prime Minister of Jamaica, Norman Manley, came to England. He wanted to see how Jamaican families were settling here in the UK, particularly after the call to come and work here. And he wanted to see how a successful family were coping in the UK. And at the time, we were deemed successful because my parents had their own house, they had bought their own property. My father was working for telecommunications as a technician. My mother was busy raising 5 children. I don't remember very much racism or prejudice in my very early days, but certainly at junior school, I remember being called names, perhaps only one of the names I can say, which is Gollywog, but we were called a number of names. I remember a specific teacher saying to me, "You will never be any good at anything." But interestingly as well, I remember growing up, things like holidays. So most people can just go on holiday at any time. My parents tell me that they would book a holiday, and of course we didn't have the internet or anything like that. So they would book a holiday and it would be Mr. and Mrs. Brown and family, and they'd be written to say absolutely fine. And when we got there, then we would be turned away.
And that was Jacinth Ivy talking about her experiences growing up in Britain and the visit from Norman Manley to her family home in 1961. So Manley came to this family and 3 others to see what a successful transition to British society looked like, which is very interesting. And I wonder if that was because he was then going on to talk about immigration and wanted to portray the Jamaican population in Britain as settled in and well-adjusted, or if he wanted to actually sell successful immigration to those back in Jamaica to alleviate some of the social issues like unemployment. And that kind of, you know, poverty, that was definitely an issue in the Caribbean, especially in Jamaica. Now, economic and financial success, if we want to call it that, by way of having a house and securing employment that allows you to raise a family and go on holiday, was definitely achieved by Caribbean immigrants, even in the 1960s and 70s. And we don't necessarily often talk about that because it's always shrouded in like the biggest mist and fog of racism and poor experience because of it. But within this context anyway, it kind of disregards another side of the story, of those that weren't able to buy a house or raise a family comfortably or find employment that suited their qualification and status beyond very menial labour. So it's interesting that he chooses these well-adjusted, quote-unquote, successful families, you know, these middle-class families that have made it. And I wonder what the intention behind that is, out of the two things, or something else I haven't considered, as to why it's only those families he visits. Or maybe he visits other families and they're not written about in the newspaper articles or spoken about at all. But it's very interesting, I think. I think, in my mind anyway, the most kind of convincing argument is that it was to show how well-adjusted Jamaican people were in Britain, and to counter the narrative that they were going to be like a burden on the state or causing a problem. They were, you know, just as capable and able as the white population to knuckle down and work and buy a house and live a middle-class life. The reporting on this extended well beyond the UK. In a Kingston Gleaner, published the 13th of June 1961, one of the front page stories was, and I quote for the headline, "Controversy over speech by Premier," the Premier being Norman Manley, and it centres on the fact that he insisted in a speech that immigration controls were race-based, coming back to the argument I made at the start of the episode, and motivated by colour prejudice. He gave a speech over the weekend that he was in Britain, so the weekend before the 13th, I'm assuming, of what is described as being full of a mixed crowd, and I quote, of heckling Mosleyites, Oswald Mosley's fascist supporters. And he is quoted to have said in his speech that if Britain made a move to stop coloured immigration at this time, it would be, and a quote of his, "the last bastion of liberal thought and action." And the newspaper goes on to say, "in the eye of the world facing the crucial problems of colour and race would have fallen." And so they're talking about how Britain will be perceived passing these laws that are seemingly so obviously and blatantly race-based and full of colour prejudice. The Sunday Mercury and the Weekly Post of Birmingham, on their front page actually reported Mr. Manley as saying on arrival in Birmingham on Saturday, and I quote, "I believe the basic reason for control is colour. And what is more, I believe that it is not a spontaneous feeling on the part of the people, but something that is being stimulated from the top and exploited." So he is very much aware and had clocked into the fact that this immigration issue that was being conjured up in Britain wasn't necessarily something that was coming from the people as a genuine concern, but something which he was arguing was exploited, stimulated from the top and exploited, like an anti-immigrant feeling. And he goes on to talk about the issues of unemployment in Britain versus in Jamaica, which in Jamaica it was notably higher, especially with the age group 16 to 25. And comparing those two age groups across the two countries, he was noting how bad the situation was, and not really something that England should be, you know, complaining about. And also I'm being reminded at this time that Jamaica is a British colony, so Britain, you know, are ruling that country. So he has every right to appeal to Britain to not, you know, close their borders to Jamaican citizens or Caribbean citizens, Commonwealth citizens coming in. He has every right to kind of make those demands and stimulate this kind of conversation. He also goes on to talk about and is reported to speak about the housing situation. And he was kind of alluding to the fact that the housing crisis, or so-called housing crisis, that's occurring in Britain isn't because of Caribbean immigrants, Commonwealth citizens, coloured people, is because there's a housing crisis, full stop. And he said whether they were Commonwealth citizens or not, there would be a housing crisis and there would be a shortage, and that the kind of people at the top, government ministers, were kind of exploiting this problem that wasn't as big a problem as they were making it out to be in order to pass this prejudice on through legislation. Manley's also reported to talk about the current contribution that Jamaican citizens are making to the British economy. And I think maybe that's why he went to those quote unquote successful families, which is noted right at the end of the article, literally the final line. You know, Manley is also set to visit four families in Birmingham, or also went on to visit four families in Birmingham. It's just a sentence. They don't really discuss it. His speeches are what draws the kind of media attention and the story. And, you know, he's really adamant that if Britain do this and impose this immigration ban, or any kind of bar or blocking or curbing, the world will know that they are racist, despite what words they use or language they try and bring about to cover it up. The world will know exactly what this actually meant. And it's interesting that he uses, I think, the argument of contribution, because he's, I guess, you know, trying to suggest and prove that Caribbean people, immigrant populations in Britain, are only contributing and providing and serving as it feels like we've had to do for decades following these migrations in big numbers of the 50s and 60s, consistently proving that as a quote-unquote Windrush generation, we've contributed and we've, you know, kind of earned a right to be here, and there's no reason why we should be kind of treated in this way. And every time we are treated badly with things like immigration, and it is a lot of the time immigration, whether it's, you know, this ban on immigration that's coming in 1961 in this moment, or when we fast forward to something like the Windrush scandal, and the conversation was very much about, well, how can you treat people like this that have contributed so much? It's always about contribution. It's always about what, you know, the Caribbean in by way of labour is giving to Britain. And there's such a long history of Caribbean people and formerly enslaved African people that then quote-unquote become Caribbean due to the way that nation is built there, and, you know, identity shifts, constantly contributing to Britain and British society and having to reference that all the time in order to prove that we deserve to be treated properly. So it's very interesting that this language and rhetoric is very much the same in 1961. And I'm sure I could go all the way to 1905 to find very similar language on immigration that we will be hearing, I'm sure, in the next coming weeks as this general election campaign gets underway. So to round up this episode, I think it's very clear and quite a nice example of the care that exists even when people leave the Caribbean from their Caribbean leaders, in this case, Norman Manley, coming to Britain and going to these families. And I'm sure it was also to fit into a wider political agenda on immigration, but also what it meant to the families that were visited in Jacinth Ivey's testimony, and also in the article on Birmingham Live. She talks about how proud her dad is to have the Prime Minister in his home in Britain, where he has, you know, successfully been able to buy that despite challenges in banks not giving them mortgages because they're black, and jobs turning them away. And even in an area, King's Heath, which they mention, that didn't really have black families in it, because A, the racism, and B, you know, people wouldn't sell a house to a black person or rent to a black person. And so they're in this area where there are very few people that look like them. And the pride that they would have, you know, imagine you migrate from a country and then your prime minister from said country comes to your new country and comes to visit you. And I'm not sure how the families were selected or how they were chosen. But I think it is, there must have been such a pride in her parents. And maybe as she's gotten older and understands, you know, not meeting Manley as a little child and thinking back, you know, there's got to be a real kind of full circle moment, I think, about something like that. And it is nice to see these examples, I think, despite the potential kind of political overtone of it, of Manly visiting. And if anybody knows of any other examples of other leaders visiting Britain or even the US to visit the populations of those people that have migrated out, I'd be really interested. I really do like a transnational history, as I'm sure you're aware, but also when we get to link back to the Caribbean and kind of have these full circle moments. So that is the end of the episode. I wanted to say thank you so much for listening. If you would like to come to the live show, please do buy your tickets. I really can't wait to meet you. And I will be announcing some exciting elements of the live show. The live show is scheduled to be around 90 minutes. And I'm sure you're aware that as much as I can talk and do many solo episodes here, 90 minutes of just me is not going to be the case for the live show. So please do get your tickets, and I'll see you all in September. But until then, have a wonderful week. Thank you so much for listening. Goodbye.